Hello and welcome to our October edition of the Centre for Brexit Studies podcast. Today we'll be discussing the possible implications of Brexit on SMEs. In the studio with me today, I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Jacob Salder, who along with his work with us, works as part of the Centre for Enterprise, Innovation and Growth to progress research focused on SME development in the regional context within the UK, with a specific focus on growth and development in the West Midlands. Jacob, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Jess.
So, Jacob, we'll just go straight on into the questions. We appear to be moving into a critical phase of the Brexit negotiations, but as yet there is relatively little clear guidance on what leaving the EU will mean for businesses. Particularly, we've seen a focus on large businesses, the like of car manufacturers and banks, but little seems to have been discussed in relation to small and medium-sized enterprises, or SMEs. What sort of impact will Brexit have on SMEs?
Well, that's very much the £350 million question, if we'll phrase it in that way. And the main thing we have at the moment is we don't really know. We don't really know because there's lots of ambiguity still around what Brexit is. There's lots of discussion and debate around it, around exactly what the conditions under which we leave are going to be. There's lots of political posturing and political rhetoric, but we've got limited detail. A lot of disagreement around what the details dependent on the specific circumstances under which we leave. But alongside those ambiguities, you have the diversity of the SME sector itself. The SME sector is huge. You're talking about 99% of businesses within the UK. Well, technically 99.7% of businesses. So it's, you know, getting close to the full whack. And that covers a large number of units. So everything from, you know, a sole trader operating out of their bedroom, or living room as it may be, to a firm that employs 249 people, manufacturing hugely sophisticated component parts, which could be a critical element in an international production chain or supply chain. So it makes it very difficult to define exactly what it's going to mean because of that diversity. And you add to that also, we've had that the focus on Brexit has principally been macroeconomic. What we've been talking about most of the time is what the implications are going to be for the rate of growth, what the implications are going to be for how fast the economy grows or doesn't grow, what we can take off various different GDP or GVA outputs over the coming years immediately after it. And alongside that, you know, work on where work has been conducted on SMEs, it tends to be very fragmented. It tends to look a very specific sector and a very specific element within that sector. So at the top level, we're getting, you know, lots of detail which isn't being translated into meaning. And at the sort of the micro level, we're getting very focused meaning on a small number of sectors or industries, which isn't translated into something generalizable. So we are in a little bit of a limbo, really.
Although SMEs represent over 99% of all businesses, only a relatively small number of these are involved in international trading. How is Brexit really relevant to those that don't import or export?
Probably the best way to think about this is to think in the terms of the various different consistencies being in the EU offers us. And when I talk about these consistencies, I'm talking about the four freedoms. That's the freedom of movement of goods, services, capital, and labour, alongside the consistency of regulation of a uniform rule book that the EU offers us. So if we focus first on goods, well, it's highly likely that if you are involved in any sort of extended production chain, this will incorporate an element of European business. Now, as direct exporters, only about 10% of SMEs export, although this does get larger the firms get, so it's actually more like a third of medium-sized enterprises. Those are the ones that employ between 50 and 249 businesses. And on top of the initial 10% of SME exporters, around 11% are directly supply exporters themselves. But if you think about something like, you know, a commodity good such as food, around 60% of the food that we import comes from the EU. So if you are in any way reliant on those imported goods, there is a potential impact on cost, depending on what the sovereign agreement is. There's a potential impact in terms of the disruption of transit and how this is going to affect your commodity chains, your distribution and your retailing of these goods. If we look at services, so whilst technically the UK is a net importer of goods, but it's a net exporter of services, so we sell more services than we buy. However, the majority of services in an economy are indigenous, so they support relatively localised household or business service demands. I'm not quite sure what the figure is at the moment, but certainly in there was some in this decade, there was some work that was done on the service industry within the West Midlands, and around one third of it was dependent on manufacturing within the UK. So, you know, if you look at the fact that we have an export market of manufactured goods in the West Midlands, which is worth around 33.7 billion, around 44% of that goes directly into the EU. Now, if a third of the services industry is dependent on that, disruption to that sort of to transfer of those goods and that market has a potential impact on a number of jobs that are peripheral to that industry. If we think about moving on to the capital side of things, you know, finance. Finance has been a major issue for SMEs in the UK. There's been a limits in the type of finance they can acquire to help them grow. So principally in the UK, this is fundamentally focused on debt-based financing and equity financing to help support businesses, you know, move into innovative activities and work on various different more risky development practices has been pretty limited. We may get to the point where actually, you know, so this might stimulate a change in that market. And that could be for benefit, actually. What we might see is actually a reduction in debt-based financing. And because there are more opportunities for firms to be doing things like exporting into new and emerging markets, this actually could lead to a rationalisation of the finance market. And this may start leading to, you know, a wider portfolio of finance options available for the firms. But at the same time, there are issues around, you know, actually what the implications are going to be long term, short to medium term, after we leave the EU, in terms of the credit worthiness of the UK and how that translates into cheap available credit for people to supplement the consumer economy. Focusing on people, the availability of labour and skilled labour specifically, we've been highly dependent on the EU here. Now, certainly in certain industries, things like agriculture and food production are very, very exposed as a result of any sort of, you know, reduced churn or reduced availability of labour. We're already in a position that because of, you know, relative success in the economy, we have high vacancy rates and certainly a poor provision of skilled labour to be able to satisfy the needs of expanding markets and expanding industries. So this is going to be a critical element of any sort of future plan. You know, how are we going to maintain that labour to satisfy the demands of the economy? And of businesses that are looking to grow and tap into that, you know, sort of the renewed, invigorated export market. And finally, there's this issue of regulation. Well, there's this presumption of freeing up EU-enforced regulation will unfetter businesses and allow them to grow more freely. But actually, such changes may have significant implications on specifically welfare standards for workers and for citizens. So you have various different statutes being put into the UK law. So there is a protection there for things like, you know, working hours directives, mm-hmm. health and safety yes. regulation. These can be removed with relative ease once they are in the UK statute book. So they may unfetter businesses and reduce barriers to businesses to grow, but actually whether the implications will be to reduce the quality of the working environment for workers and actually already contribute towards reduced levels of, you know, the poor levels of productivity we're seeing.
There's certainly some food for thought just in what you said there, really.
Yeah, I mean, well, this, you know, all these things, you know, contribute, and like I said, it's a very ambiguous and uncertain time, and I think, you know, the problem is that there isn't necessarily the wherewithal within a number of businesses to actually look at it as holistically as they need to look at it. Now, actually, if you look at something like, you know, the labour issue, the fact that we'll be able to control our immigration policy and link that to industrial strategy, that actually could be, in principle, good. That could mean that actually some of those vacancy shortages we see could be reduced because we have a much more targeted approach to recruiting the sort of labour that demands that businesses need. The problem with that is there's no way that doesn't happen without cost, because what you have is you have the government who are having to increase their regulation of immigration and implement and exercise a, you know, a strategic immigration policy with various different tests attached to it. And a number of these responsibilities are then going to be passed on to the firm. The firm will fundamentally become responsible for managing their, having a more comprehensive management, you know, labour management plan or labour management strategy in order to, you know, make sure that the people they employ have got visas, that those visas are kept up to date. So there is, you know, no way that there is not additional work, additional cost, and additional administrative burden at both state and at firm level for this.
So although this might be the point where we say, okay, this is about finding those opportunities that people are talking about,
yeah.
It's important we realise, yes, we can find opportunities, but there is going to be possible significant cost involved as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, this is, and this is about, actually, that leads quite nicely into
question three. So, Brexit is expected to cause considerable disruption, but many theorists argue disruption is both good and necessary for the improvement of economies. What sort of opportunities for SMEs might emerge from Brexit?
Well, we're talking about the disruption. What we're essentially talking about here are what we call Schumpeterian theories of creative destruction, which were developed by an Austrian economist called Joseph Schumpeter during, I think, the 1930s. And what he argued is that where you see structural challenges with an economy, the firms within that economy fundamentally look to seek new ways of doing things, so they will encourage them to be innovative, to reconfigure their products and their services and also their processes and their practices. And he also, I mean, I think the important link here is that he argued that within such environments, SMEs are absolutely critical, because what we see is governments are too bureaucratic to be able to make these and implement these changes fast, and similarly large firms are too flabby is probably not the word, but they're certainly too rigid to be able to respond as quickly as they need to. So, you know, the SMEs play a very important role here. I guess, you know, some of those things will be around structural challenges in terms of the labour gaps that might emerge. This potential could be quite good for encouraging new forms of training, as we need to respond relatively swiftly to reconfiguring the economy, maybe to, let's say that we are talking about increasing levels of export, you know, moving back towards different forms of manufacturing, the advanced manufacturing that the government talk about, high-value manufacturing the government talk about quite a lot. This is going to have, you know, sort of considerable demands for new skills, and also linking what are traditional manufacturing skills, workshop-based skills, with the future of manufacturing, whether it's, you know, familiarity with computer-aided design and the advancement into things like 3D printing. So there are lots of training opportunities. There are also lots of investment opportunities, really, plant and machinery, new skills, new knowledge, collaborations and partnerships, which could benefit firms and also could benefit institutions such as universities. And automation is, of course, the big issue, the big elephant in the room, if you want to look at this. Actually, how much we're going to see that where those labour gaps are emerging, people will look to invest in different forms of automation to actually remove the human element out of their production line, and, you know, reduce the exposure they have to reduced amounts of labour. And I'd mentioned before that we have the potential for new forms of financing. And which way we go on this, you don't know, and it will very much depend on what governments we have after Brexit. But you may end up having, you know, even further liberalisation of the finance industry, or you may have much firmer regulation on it. What that may lead to is that, you know, borrowing becomes difficult, more difficult from a debt-based perspective, but you may have something like venture capital, equity-based financing. We have a very poor venture capital industry in this country, and firms can't really acquire it very easily. That actually, they may change as a result of Brexit. We may see this industry actually kickstart to try and nurture and encourage the manufacturing industry. But alongside these structural challenges, there are a number of key issues that are not necessarily related to Brexit, and these are going to present big challenges for us to address, but also they're going to challenge the economy to respond in particular ways, which may create all sorts of new jobs and new opportunities for business. One of these is around demographic change. If we see the population age and the fact that this has been tempered by high migration from the EU, certainly the Eastern European countries, as that reduces, as we would assume it would do, certainly we're going to have a look at the service provision and the funding models for care of this growing dependent population, and look at how we address higher intensity needs and increased levels of frailty. We'll also need to look at automation. Automation is going to be a massive thing, and we're seeing potentially a number of low-skilled jobs stripped out of the market by automated processes. But that's going to create new forms of manufacturing and new forms of services to be able to keep these this automated parts of a production line up and running. And finally, you're going to see massive changes in finance, moving from a debt-based financial consumption-based economy to something that may be, this is maybe focused on more equity-based investment. It may be focused more on crowdfunding type models as they're, you know, they're emerging and becoming increasingly popular. And there may be a greater link between between savings and investment. Maybe we might see a move back to the days of the mutuals, building societies, where you had a direct link between a local saver and a local borrower. So there are certainly big, you know, big disruptions going to be there, but these may have quite notable positive impacts and offer positive changes.
Thank you, Jacob. You previously mentioned the diversity of industries found in the SME sector. How might these variations affect the impact of Brexit?
Again, it's a difficult one to try and predict, but I think an element here is to focus on the characteristics of specific industries, and they can be quite radically different. So instead of focusing on, again, I've mentioned our tendency to focus on macroeconomic tendencies, but the way the economy is functioning and how it's going up and down, how fast it's growing, that is an aggregate picture of the economy and is rarely represented by any single sector. Instead, it's the coming together of all the information from all these individual sectors which creates that aggregate picture. So it's not a uniform thing. So what you need to think about is the tendencies for growth in those specific sectors. So we look at manufacturing. Generally, it's been in decline for 20 to 30 years. Alongside that, you know, or you look at something like the creative industries, where has been, you know, employment within the creative industries has been a massive success this century and has been growing much faster than employment in any other sector of the economy. You might want to think about whether your firms are you driven by, you know, indigenous demand or export demand, and the extent to which you are integrated into those international supply chains, and how far down that chain is. So how we might replicate that, how you might change those EU dependencies. Specific determinants will be key to the industry, such as, is it resource based? So is it simply on based, you know, an old extraction industry such as coal or metal mining? Is it people based? Are you dependent just on people delivering a direct service for you? Is it skills based, or is it a knowledge based industry that requires very specific understandings of where and how you acquire that understanding? What is the continuing likelihood of a continuing demand for specific products that are key to your industry? And does this require you to diversify in any way? Or think about what the added value is of the specific products and services that you deliver. So, you know, if we focus on one specific industry, you look at manufacturing. I mentioned the manufacturers being in decline, but we've seen a renaissance in manufacturing on the back of the devaluation of the pound. And therefore, this has had an impact in terms of its export performance. But obviously, that devaluation of the pound has implications on other industries as well. You know, we've seen something of a, meant to be a renaissance in the tourist industry as people come to the UK because you've had a fantastic summer, and people have capitalised on that by whether it's staying in the UK because the euro is too expensive, or you're not getting so much bang for your pound if you go to Europe, or whether it's people from Europe coming over to the UK to capitalise on the fact that their euro goes a lot further. But this has obviously certain reciprocal disadvantages. So that, you know, if you're an exporter and you're selling to a European market, all of a sudden you're a lot cheaper. If you're an importer, you're buying from European markets, obviously all of a sudden everything is a lot more expensive, and that has to some way been represented with various different, you know, goods values. And and I think inflation figures to a certain extent, although they had fallen recently, hadn't they? So, and then you have to think about what the influences of the specific industries will be in terms of negotiating the nature of the deal. Now, so when you're in the introductory question, we talked about the automotive industry and the finance industry. So both of these industries have been highly prevalent in discussions and very influential in trying to put pressure on the Prime Minister and the government, and also on the EU as well, in terms of with the nature of any deal. So in many respects, the finance industry and the automotive industry are being very well represented in any sort of negotiations. And there are a set of other industries which certainly aren't going to be well represented. So, you know, the nature of that deal is being influenced by an ongoing dialogue that's being had between industry, between the UK government, and between the EU.
Considering these challenges, what can SMEs do to prepare?
I think, you know, we're back to one of those £350 million questions again. I think in the first instance, certainly the work that we do with SMEs, what we tend to see is that they are operationally very, very busy. And that's great, and it's very important, that's very important. But what we also find a lot of the time is that there is a tendency to not focus on strategic issues and to think strategically about their business. So whether that's thinking, A, how am I looking to develop my business? Or whether they're thinking about, B, where does my business fit into a wider production system or supply or value chain. So I guess the first thing would be to think strategically about, you know, where you want to take your business and how you exactly how your business relates to the people you sell to and the people you buy from as part of that value chain. The other one is to think of, for you to try and use this environmental perspective I talked about, those five consistencies, to think about, you know, what could be the big implications. What are the potential implications in terms of changes to the transfer or the freedom of movement of goods, of services, of finance, and of people? What are the implications for your business in terms of regulatory reform, particularly the stuff that is controlled by the EU? And finally, I guess we would say now is the time to think about how you can acquire different forms of knowledge or different skill sets to be able to allow you to respond that to these challenges. And that's where things like working with universities could be key. So this allow you to capitalize on the available knowledge and experience or expertise within local local institutions, you know, be that the universities or the colleges, or working with other organizations designed to support businesses, growth hubs, etc. There is a wide support network there, so to try and engage with that somehow and find how that work out how that can help you.
Thank you very much, Jacob. Also possibly a nice link into BCU Advantage.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
And indeed the Centre for Brexit Studies.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jacob. It's been really interesting. I hope you'll come in again.
Anytime.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Jacob Salder, once again. I really do appreciate you taking the time to share your expertise with me and our listeners. If you're looking for more Brexit research news and updates, then why not visit our website at www.bcu.ac.uk/centre-for-brexit-studies, or find us on Twitter at BCU_CBS. Bye for now.